So, David, when did you start exploring your field? Was there a specific event that led you to this path of waking up?
Well, yes, very much so. I was a presenter with the BBC, presenter of sport and news on BBC television out of London. And I'd also started to get involved in green politics because I saw the world that I grew up in being concreted over and many environmentally unpleasant things being done. And my life has been an extraordinary series of synchronicities in the sense that I became a professional footballer, which I wanted to be from when I was a kid. And the synchronistic sequence of events that led me to being a footballer was extraordinary in itself. And then I had a professional football career until I was 21, which I had to finish with because of arthritis. And then again, there was a synchronistic series of events that led to me being a newspaper journalist, a radio journalist, eventually a television journalist, and then becoming a green politician for a time. And these apparently unconnected professions, I later understood were links in a chain, because the emotional strength that losing the football career I dreamed about from when I was a kid gave me emotional strength, and the media career in newspapers and radio and television showed me how the media works and how the media is not a vehicle for telling people what is happening in the world, but for telling people what the system, the establishment, if you like, is what wants people to think is going on in the world. And then I got into green politics, and that gave me the insight to see how politics works. And it's very, very horrible sight, I can tell you. Even these, Green Party in Britain kind of just fell into the same program. And I think during this chat, the word program is going to come up a lot. And then while I was still in green politics, I was a national spokesman for the British Green Party, and I was still working for the BBC as a presenter. Some very strange things started to happen to me during 1989. When I was in a room alone, it was like I wasn't alone, that there was a presence there. It's nothing you could see, but it was something you could feel. And this went on and on for a year, and got more and more powerful, more and more tangible, until in early 1990, I was sitting on a bed in a hotel room in London, working for the BBC, in a room alone, apparently. And this presence was so powerful, so there, that I said out loud, "If there's something there, if there's someone there, would you please contact me? Because you're driving me up the wall." A few days later, maybe just slightly more than a few days, but not long, I was in a bookshop on the Isle of Wight, just 10 minutes from where I'm sitting now, in off the south coast of England. And I was with my son, Gareth, who's a big strapping guy now, but was a little boy then. And someone stopped me. We're on the seafront here, and someone stopped me, a railway worker, because the railway station's down on the seafront, to talk to me about football, because that's what I was presenting, among other things, for the BBC. And after this little chat, I realized that Gareth was no longer there, but I knew where he would be. He'd be in this bookshop newsagent on the seafront. And I went in to say to him, "Come on, we'll get off and go into the town." And as I looked at him, and he was reading a book. And as I went to turn to go out, it was like my feet were stuck to the ground, and the feeling was like magnets pulling my feet into to the floor. And of course, I'm standing there completely bewildered. I've come across nothing like this before. Nothing like this had ever happened to me before. And at this point, where I'm trying to work out what's going on, this, I wouldn't say it was a voice. It was more like a very strong thought form went through my mind, and it said, "Go and look on the books. Go and look at the books on the far side." And of course, in my bewilderment with all this going on, it's like, what is happening? So I started to walk towards these books, which I knew this news agent very well, still there. And I knew that the books were basically romantic novels for the tourists and what have you, because this is a seaside town that I live in. And I walked across, and in among the romantic novels, the Mills and Boone as they were then, and the Barbara Cartlands, was this book with a woman's face on it. And I was attracted to it because it was different, first of all. And I picked it up, and it was called Mind to Mind. And I turned it over, and I looked at the blurb on the back, and I saw the word psychic. And it was the life story of a psychic called Betty Shine. And as soon as I saw the word psychic, I got interested, because my immediate thought, standing there with a book in my hand, was, I wonder if this woman would be able to pick up what I've been feeling around me for the last year. So I took it home. I read it, and I read it in a day, and I contacted her and went to see her. And she lived off the near a place called Brighton, not too far from me. And I went to see her the first time, and what I said to her was, "I've got arthritis, which is what ended my football career. And I wonder if your hands-on healing, which is what she also did, would maybe help." And part of me was interested in that, but the real reason was, will she pick this up? And of course, I wasn't going to tell her anything what was happening to me, because that just would be ridiculous. So I turn up the first time, I get the hands-on healing, had a nice chat, same the second time. And then the third time, I'm lying on this kind of medical bench couch thing in her front room, and she's doing sort of hands-on healing near my left knee, and suddenly I felt like a spider's web on my face. And what struck me immediately was that that's what I'd read in her book. She said that when other levels of reality, whatever you want to call them, other realities of existence, entities, whatever, are trying to lock into you, you sometimes feel like a spider's web on your face. Now, of course, what I didn't know then, but what I know now, is what that feeling was electromagnetic energy. There was an electromagnetic connection being made into that room. And this is the kind of the same kind of energy you get when you are in a big sports stadium, and everyone's excited, and people say, "Oh, look, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up." It was so, and what makes that happen? What makes that happen is an electromagnetic field generated by the excitement of the crowd. Anyway, what then starts, because about, I don't know, 10 seconds later, a bit more maybe, and I never said a word to what I was feeling to Betty Shine, she launches her head backwards, and said, "My God, this is powerful. I've got to close my eyes for this one." And I'm, of course, sitting there, and I've come across none of this ever before. And she starts to tell me that she's seeing a figure in her mind. And the figure said that they knew you wanted them to contact you, but the time wasn't right. And I'd never said a word to her that, I'd said to them, "Would you please contact me, because you're driving me up the wall." And she said that she was going to tell me what they were communicating to me. And it was that I was going to go out on a world stage and reveal great secrets. That one line was, one man cannot change the world, but one man can communicate the message that can change the world. Yeah. And that there was basically a story that had to be told, that there was a mass awakening coming. And it would, and this mass awakening, I dubbed in my first book after this, the truth vibrations, because what I was being told is that this this energetic change, what I now know to be an information change, a consciousness change, was going to act like a spiritual alarm clock, and it was going to wake more and more people up to see the world as it is, rather than they had been led to believe it is, and that the most awake would be touched by this first, but eventually, in my words, even the solid gold asleep were going to be affected by it. And when I look back, Kim, over 25 years now, just 25 years in March, God, just gone. At that point where I was in that front room with Betty Shine, there was absolutely no evidence whatsoever that anything of the kind was happening. But when I look around now, having been, you know, on the journey for this a quarter of a century, yeah. I see a phenomenal awakening going on. Yeah. No, it's not the majority. No, it's not even nearly the majority.
No.
But the number of people now worldwide who are willing to look at things and look at concepts and information,
yeah,
with an open mind rather than a concrete one, and the kind of people that are now starting to be touched by this, in the sense that they're starting to think thoughts they thought they never would, that's, you know, what I call, you know, people in the dark suit professions of the system, is very, very encouraging, and certainly supports what I was told was going to happen all those years ago.
Fantastic.
And from that time, in that front room, my life has been this synchronistic series of quote coincidences and walking into information in multi and various ways and multi and various kinds, which has given me a picture. It's been like somebody in the unseen has been handing me pieces in a puzzle, it's still going on today, and it's taken me into realms well beyond what most people perceive as normal, most people perceive as what is real. And this lovely line that I hear all the time, beyond what people perceive to be the real world.
Yeah.
So the next question I say to those people is, okay, what is the real world?
Yeah.
And very quickly, you can establish with people that it's actually the world they've been told is real. And I think it's the first step in, well, it is a process of deprogramming, for reasons I'll come to. The first step to being able to step out of the position of slavery is to realize that you are a slave, because you cannot do anything about being a slave if you think you're free. Not possible. And what we're looking at is and you know, this goes deep in the rabbit hole, but we're looking at a mass control system where the few are controlling the many, and we can talk about banking scams and political scams and engineered wars, but we can talk about that, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But they're all peripheral to the main foundation of this control system.
Yeah,
and that is the control of human perception.
Yeah.
It is to manipulate people to believe that slavery is normal and slavery is freedom and slavery is the real world, mate. And if you're saying that I'm a slave, you must be mad. I mean, what we're looking at, I've said this in the books many times, we're looking at a world that's inverted. It's an inversion. Everything is inverted. Everything is upside down. And so, and you know, you look at the sort of things that George Orwell talked about, the concepts of control that George Orwell talked about in 1984.
Yeah.
And basically, what are we looking at? We're looking at an inversion. When he talks about, you know, war is peace, freedom is slavery and all that stuff, what we're looking at, we're looking at inversion. It's all about inversion. And what I would say to people who dismiss all this and say, oh, it's a load of rubbish, I'm in the real world, is where does your perception of the real world come from? And it starts when you leave the womb, and parents, most of the time, the overwhelming majority of the time, not through malevolence, but by believing they're doing the best thing for their children, they are telling you what is real and not real, what is good and bad, what is possible and impossible. It starts at the earliest age, the programming, the perception programming, because what you've got there at stage one is parents who've been through the program I'm going to describe and accepted it as reality, accepted it as normal, then being programmers for their children out of what they think is love, not out of malevolence. And then a very short time, shorter all the time, it seems to me, the child is into some kind of school system. Maybe 3 years after leaving the womb and entering this reality, maybe four, they are sitting in a classroom of some kind with an authority figure telling them what's right, what's wrong, what's possible, what's impossible, what to believe, what not to believe, when you can go to the toilet, when you can't, when you must be there, when you can go home. And even, you know, pretty soon impacting upon your home life with what they call homework. And so if you just look at it from up to this point, the child's just, you know, not long in this world, and already the programming is very powerful. Now, your schoolmates around you who are going through the same program, they will confirm to you as they accept it that that is normal. You look how at the earliest age, it is extraordinary. Even little kids who are different in some way will be turned upon by the group often, not always, but outrageously often, given how young they are when it starts.
Yeah.
You then go through the school system, which is nothing more than a reality programming system. It's telling you everything that the system wants you to know, and it's not telling you everything that the system does not want you to know. People are debating all the time about how children are taught. Should it be this method or that method? But there is virtually no debate on what they are taught and what they are not taught. Why? Because the parents looking on, most of them, have been through that system, so that's their norm, and so the norm is okay for their children. And then you go on to to college and university, and you do that at another level. And all the way through, you have something called exams, in which you are tested on how much of the programming you have downloaded. Mm-hmm. And if you've downloaded it really well, and what that basically needs most of the time to pass exams is not intelligence, it's not wisdom, it's not free thought, it's memory. Yeah. The ability to memorize and regurgitate that memory onto a paper at one specific point called an exam. And yeah. Soon after that, most of the kids will forget what they knew at the time of the exam. And the pressure is on children more and more to pass their exams because that's the program. Mm. And so I would say to people that say, they live in the real world and anything outside of that must be crazy. I'd say to them this, if you look at what human life is, against all possibility, which is what we are all possibility. You look at what human life is for most people. It is born, few years of relative freedom, maybe three, maybe four, but in this period you are starting the programming as parents impose what they believe is right through their program onto you. You then go to school and you are then going through the programming or the perception programming all the way through your school life. You then go into the world of so-called work. And what is happening through school, and we hear this all, more and more, certainly in Britain, we hear the term, schools must prepare young people for the workplace. What that means is not that school and education should set out to bring the unique self out of every child so that every child can express their unique abilities, their unique gifts. No, the opposite is the case. It must mold the child to fit the workplace. And so you then go out into the world of work and you chase a career. And you're told that going up and up and up in this career, going higher and higher and getting a bigger and bigger title and position is what life is all about, and earning more and more and more money. And to achieve that, unless you've got rich parents, you have to go into terrific amounts of life-changing debt to pay for your education at university, so that you can pay for your own programming. So you go out into the world of work and you go on and on and on. And you then reach a point, which a lot of people reach later in life, where they get to these positions that they were striving through life for. And suddenly they say, what was it all about? I don't feel any different now than I felt before. I thought this was going to give me something. I thought this was going to give me happiness. I thought this was going to give me joy, but it's not. It's just given me more stress. Yeah. And so you see this program going through birth, through school, through higher education, into the workplace, and on into retirement, and on into the cemetery. And then you take another aspect of this, where the idea is that you come into the world, you reach a certain age, you meet someone of the opposite sex or whatever, and then you have children, and then you have a family, and then you go on into retirement and into the cemetery. Now, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with having those aspirations, if that's what people choose to have. My point is this. When we are in a reality, in a universe of infinite possibility, why is this considered, this program, this sequence considered to be the only normal way of life. And you go anywhere in the world, and again and again, you'll basically come across this program. In some parts of the world, you might not come across the school university program in the same way, but you'll still come across this born meet someone, get married, have children kind of thing. And so look at it, I would say to people, look at it. It's a program. The more that I've studied this, the more absolutely convinced I am that we actually live in a computer simulation. And interestingly, there are more and more scientific mainstream, open-minded mainstream, not the center of the mainstream, scientific studies that are coming to basically the same conclusion. Look everywhere. What we call cycles are actually programs. Look at the cycle of any species of animal. Look at what are called the natural cycles. Look at them. They are repeating programs. And the trick is, of the control system, is to persuade you, while going from A to Z of the program, that you are doing it through free choice and free thought. And what I would say to people that want to wake up from it is, ask yourself, look at your life and ask yourself, how many of the decisions that directed your life and your direction were actually made through free thought, and how many were made through the influence of perception, starting with the parents, going through academia, and then of course you've got the omnipotent media that's constantly underpinning that slavery is normal. Once you start to realize, actually, my free thought is illusory, and that my decisions that I thought were mine were actually massively influenced through my life by external factors, be it education, parents, media, whatever, then you come to this conclusion, I am a slave. And at that point, you can start ceasing to be one. Because I would say to, most people, when you wake up in the morning, do you want to go and do what you're doing today and what you have to do? From my experience, most people would say no. Some would say yes, because they're doing what they have chosen to do. Most people would say, look, mate, I'm doing it because I have to earn money to live. Okay? So you do not have the choice, the free choice, to wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to do this. You have to do A, B, or C, because you have to earn the money to pay the bills, not just to live, but to survive. Any criteria, what I've just described is slavery. Look at a slave. They wake up in the morning and they've got to do what the slave master says. In terms of humanity, the slave master is a system which has attached humanity to it by attaching human perception to it. And therefore there's a line in the first Matrix movie about people controlled by the Matrix, controlled by the system, being so inert, being so dependent upon the system, that they'll fight to protect it. And that's what you see. When people like me are talking in these terms, those that are the very slaves I'm talking about will dismiss it as nonsense or dangerous, or and and seek to defend the system. It's like a slave defending the slave master. It's like a prisoner defending the warder in the prison. But I see it all the time.
Yeah.
And I remember once I was in a restaurant in America, and I was feeling a bit, you know, well, I said playful is not quite the word, but I was feeling a bit I was wanting to point out the system for what it was as I looked around the room. No one seemed happy there at all. So what I did is I put a bread roll on my head and sat there. And very quickly, the waiter was over asking me if I wanted another glass of wine. And when I said, yeah, all right, he said to me, don't you think you might have had enough, sir? So I said to him, so I can only put a bread roll on my head if I've had too much to drink, right? Well, no. I said, look, I'm just taking the right to freely put a bread roll on my head. Why is that a problem? Oh, is that not a problem? And we got into this conversation, and I said to him, you know, think about it. Do you think you're free? Oh, I'm free. I said, well, can you walk out of here now? No, I can't walk out of here now, mate. I've got a living to earn. I said, well, what about when you leave here? Are you free? And we went through this sequence, and eventually realized, actually, I'm forced to do so much that I never thought about it before, but I am, aren't I? Mm-hmm. And when people do that, they realize the true nature of life on earth, which for most people is a state of slavery. And that's first base. Without that, we cannot be free, because the way the system works is that it convinces slaves they are free, and therefore nothing is ever done about their slavery. And until it is, nothing can change.